Chapter 3. For the last time, we stand drawn up in the barracks square. Part of the company lives here in the neighborhood, and they are being disbanded. The rest of us must make our own way, for the railway services are so irregular that we cannot be transported farther in a body. Now we must separate. The wide gray square is much too big for us. Across it sweeps a bleak November wind, smelling of decay and death. We are lined up between the canteen and the guardroom. More space we do not require. The wide, empty square about us wakes woeful memories. There, rank on rank, invisible, stand the dead. Hale passes down the company, and behind him soundlessly walks the ghostly train of his predecessors. Nearest to him, still bleeding from the neck, his chin torn away, with sorrowful eyes, goes Bertink, company commander for a year and a half, a teacher, married, 4 children. Beside him, with black-green face, Müller, 19 years of age, gas poisoned 3 days after he took command of the company. And next, Radecker, forestry surveyor, 2 weeks later bashed into the earth by a direct hit. Then, still paler, more remote, Butner, captain, killed in a raid with a machine gun bullet through the heart. And like shadows behind them, already almost without name, so far back, the others, 7 company commanders in 2 years, and more than 500 men, 32 are now standing in the barracks square. Hale tries to say a few words in farewell, but nothing will come. He has to give up. No words in the world can take the field against this lonely, empty barracks square, and these sorry ranks of the survivors, standing there in their greatcoats and their boots, dumb and freezing, remembering their comrades. Hale passes from one to another and shakes hands with each man. When he comes to Max Vile, with thin lips he says, "Now your time begins, Vile." "It will be less bloody," answers Vile quietly. "And less heroic," Hale retorts. "That's not the only thing in life," says Vile. "But the best," Hale replies. "What else is there?" Vile pauses a moment. Then he says, "Things that sound feeble today, Herr Lieutenant. Kindliness and love. These also have their heroisms." "No," answers Hale swiftly, as though he had already long thought upon it, and his brow is clouded. "They offer only martyrdom. That is quite another thing. Heroism begins where reason leaves off, when life is set at a discount. It has to do with folly, with exaltation, with risk, and you know it, but little or nothing with purpose. Purpose, that is your word. Why, wherefore, to what end? Who asks these questions knows nothing of it." He speaks emphatically, as if he would convince himself. His worn face works. Within these few days, he has become embittered, and he looks years older. And Vile also, he has altered as rapidly. He used to be an unobtrusive sort of fellow, but then nobody could quite make him out. Now he has come suddenly to the fore, and every minute grows more decided, more assured. No one ever thought he could talk like this. And the more agitated Hale becomes, the calmer is Max. Quietly and firmly, he says, "The misery of millions is too big a price to pay for the heroics of a few." Hale shrugs his shoulders. "Price, purpose, pay, those are your words. We shall see how far they will bring you." Vile glances at the private's uniform that Hale is still wearing. And how far have yours brought you? Hale turns crimson.
To a memory, he says harshly. To a remembrance of things which at any rate are not to be had for money.
Vile is silent a moment. To a memory, he repeats, then turns and looks out over the empty square and along our scanty ranks. Yes, and to a terrible responsibility. As for us, we do not make much of all this. We are freezing, and we consider it unnecessary to talk. Talking will not make the world any different. The ranks break. The farewells begin. Mueller, the man next to me, settles the pack on his shoulders, clamps his bundle of rations under his arm. Then he stretches his hand to me.
Well, good luck, Ernst.
Good luck, Felix. He passes on to Willy, to Albert, to Cazola. Now comes Gerhard Pohl, the company singer who on the march used to sing all the top tenor notes, pursuing the melody as occasion offered up into the clouds. The remainder of the time he would rest on his oars so as to be able to put his full weight into the two-part passages. His tanned face with the wart has a troubled look. He has just parted from Karl Brugger, with whom he has played so many games of scat. That has been hard for him.
Au revoir, Ernst.
Au revoir, Gerhard. He is gone. Wedekamp gives me his hand. He used to make the crosses for the fellows who were killed.
It's a pity, Ernst, says he. I suppose I'll never be able to fit you up now. And you might have had a mahogany one, too. I was saving a lovely bit of piano lid for you.
Given time, all things must happen, I reply, grinning. I'll drop you a line when it comes to that. He laughs.
That's right. Keep smiling, lad. The war's not over yet.
Then, with stooping shoulders, he trots away. The first group has already vanished through the barracks gate. Scheffler, Fassbender, young Luca, and August Beckmann among them. Others follow. We begin to be troubled. It is difficult at first to get used to the idea of so many fellows going away for good. Heretofore it was only death or wounds or temporary transfers that depleted the company. Now peace must be reckoned with. We are so accustomed to shell holes and trenches that we are suddenly suspicious of this still green landscape, as though its stillness were but a pretense to lure us into some secretly undermined region. And now there go our comrades, hastening out into it, heedless, alone, without rifles, without bombs. One would like to run after them, fetch them back, shout to them, "Hey, where are you off to? What are you after, out there alone? You belong here with us. We must stick together. How else can we live?" Queer millwheel in the brain. Too long a soldier. The November wind pipes over the empty barrack square, yet more and more comrades go. Not long now, and every man will be alone. The rest of our company all go home by the same route. We are now lounging in the station, waiting for a train. The place is a regular army dump of chests, cardboard boxes, packs, and waterproof sheets. Only two trains pass through in 7 hours. Men hang around the doorways in clusters, in swarms. By the afternoon, we have won a place near the track, and before evening are in the best position, right at the front. The first train arrives soon after midday, a freight train with blind horses. Their skewed eyeballs are blue-white and red-rimmed. They stand stock still, their heads outstretched, and there is life only in the quivering sense of their nostrils. During the afternoon, it is announced that no more trains will leave today. Not a soul moves. A soldier does not believe in announcements. And in point of fact, another train does come. One glance suffices. This will do. Half full at the most. The station hall reverberates to the assembling of gear and the charge of the columns that stampede from the waiting rooms and burst in wild confusion upon the men already in the hall. The train glides up. One window is open. Albert Troske, lightest and nimblest of us, is heaved up and clambers through like a monkey. Next moment, all the doors are blocked with men. Most of the windows are shut. But already some are being shattered with blows from rifle butts, by fellows who mean to get aboard at any price, though it should cost them torn hands and legs. Blankets are flung over the jagged glass points, and here and there the boarding is already in progress. The train stops. Albert has run through the corridors and now flings open the window in front of us. Tjaden and the dog shoot in first, Baitka and Kozola after them, Vili shoving from behind. The three at once make for the doors opening into the corridor so as to close the compartment on both flanks. Then follows the baggage, along with Ludwig and Lederhose, then Valentin, Karl Brugger and I, and after clearing the decks about him once more, last of all, Vili.
All in,
shouts Kozola from the gangway, where the pressure is becoming momently more urgent.
All aboard,
bawls Vili. Then, as if fired from a pistol, Baitka, Kozola, and Tjaden shoot into their seats, and outsiders pour into the compartment, climb up on the luggage rack till every possible inch of space is occupied. Even the engine has been stormed, and there are fellows sitting on the buffers. The roofs of the carriages are swarming with men.
Come down out of that, cries the guard. You'll get your bloody brains knocked out. You hold your gas, we're all right, it comes back.
There are five men sitting in the lavatory. One has his behind sticking through the window. The train pulls out. Some, who were not holding on fast enough, fall off. Two are run over and dragged away, but others jump their places immediately. The footboards are full. The crowding gets worse as the train goes on. One man is hanging on to a door. It swings open and he dangles clear, clutching the window. Vili clambers across, seizes him by the collar, and hoists him in. During the night, our carriage has its first casualties. The train passed into a low tunnel, and some of the chaps on the roof were crushed and swept clean off. Though the others had seen it, they had no means up there of stopping the train. The man in the lavatory window, too, fell asleep and dropped out. Other carriages also suffered similar casualties, so now the roofs are rigged up with wooden grips and ropes and bayonets rammed into the woodwork, and sentries are posted to give warning of danger. We sleep and sleep, standing, lying, sitting, squatting in every possible attitude on packs and on bundles, we sleep. The train rattles on. Houses, trees, gardens, people waving, processions, red flags, guards posted on the railway, shouting, cries, special editions, revolution. But we will sleep first. The rest can wait till later. Now, for the first time, one begins to feel how tired one has become in all these years. Evening again. There is one miserable lamp burning. The train moves slowly and stops often because of engine trouble. Our packs joggle. Pipes are glowing. The dog is asleep on my knees. Adolf Bethke leans across to me and strokes the dog's head.
Well, Ernst, he says after a while, we're going to separate at last.
I nod. It is strange, but I can hardly picture life now without Adolf, without his watchful eye and his quiet voice. It was he that educated Albert and me when we first came out to the front as raw recruits. But for him, I doubt if I should still be here. We must meet sometimes, Adolf, I say. We must meet often. The heel of a boot catches me in the face. On the rack over our heads sits Tjaden, earnestly counting his money. He means to go straight from the station to a brothel. To put himself in a proper frame of mind, he is now regaling us with the story of his adventures with a couple of girls. No one thinks of it as indecent. It has nothing to do with the war, so we listen readily. A sapper, who has lost two fingers, is boasting that his wife has given birth to a 7-month child, and yet in spite of that it weighs 8 pounds. Lederhosa jeers at him. Things don't happen that way. The sapper does not follow him, and begins to count on his fingers the months between his last leave and the birth of the child.
7, says he. That's right.
Lederhosa coughs, and his lemon-yellow face draws to a wry, mocking smile.
Somebody's been doing a little job for you there.
The sapper looks at him.
What do you mean, eh?
He stutters.
Why, it's obvious enough, surely,
says Arthur, sniffling and scratching himself. Sweat breaks out on the man's lip. He counts over and over again. His mouth twitches. A fat ASC driver with a beard sitting by the window is convulsed with laughter.
You poor fool! You poor bloody fool!
Bethke stiffens.
Shut your mug, fat guts!
Why?
Asks the fellow with the beard.
Because you ought to shut your mug, says Bethke. You too, Arthur.
The sapper has turned pale.
What does one do about it?
He asks helplessly, holding fast to the window frame.
One shouldn't get married,
says Jupp deliberately.
Until one's children are already out earning, then that sort of thing wouldn't happen.
Outside, the evening draws on. Woods lie along the skyline like black cows. Fields show faintly in the dim light that shines from the carriage windows. It now wants but 2 hours for home. Bethke is getting his baggage ready. He lives in a village a few stations this side of the town, and so has to get out sooner. The train stops. Adolf shakes hands with us all. He tumbles out onto the little siding and looks about him with a sweeping glance that drinks in the whole landscape in a second, as a parched field the rain. Then he turns to us again, but he hears nothing anymore. Ludwig Breyer is standing at the window, indifferent to his pain.
Trot along, Adolf, he says. Your wife will be waiting.
Bethke looks up at us and shakes his head.
No such hurry as all that, Ludwig.
It is evident with what power home is drawing him away. But Adolf is Adolf. He continues to stand there beside us until the train leaves. Then he turns swiftly about and goes off with long strides.
We'll be coming to see you soon,
I call after him hastily. We watch him go out across the fields. For a long time he continues to wave. Then smoke from the engine drifts between. In the distance gleam a few red lights. The train makes a big, sweeping curve. Adolf has now become very small, a mere point, a tiny little man, quite alone on the wide, dark plain, above which, vast and electrically bright, ringing the horizon in sulfur yellow, towers the night sky. I do not know why. It has nothing to do with Adolf, but the sight fascinates me. A solitary man going out over the wide stretch of fields against the mighty sky in the evening and alone. Then the trees close up in massive darkness, and soon nothing is left but swift motion and woods and the sky. It grows noisy in the compartment. Here inside are corners, edges, odors, warmth, space and boundaries. Here are brown, weathered faces and eyes with bright flecks in them. There is a smell of earth, sweat, blood, uniforms. But outside, the world is rushing obscurely past to the steady stamping of the train. We are leaving it behind us, ever farther and farther, all that world of trenches and shell holes, of darkness and terror. Now a mere whirlwind seen through the window, it concerns us no more. Somebody starts singing. Others join in. Soon everyone is singing, the whole compartment, the next compartment, the entire carriage, the whole train. We sing ever more lustily, with more and more power. Our brows are flushed, the veins swell out. We sing every soldier's song that we know. We stand up, glaring at each other. Our eyes shine, the wheels thunder the rhythm. We sing and sing. I am wedged between Ludwig and Kozola and feel their warmth penetrating my tunic. I move my hands, turn my head. My muscles brace themselves, and a shiver mounts from my knees to my belly. A ferment like sherbet in my bones. It rises, foams up into my lungs, my lips, my eyes. The carriage swims. It sings in me as a telegraph pole in a storm, thousands of wires twanging, thousands of roads opening. Slowly, I put my hand on Ludwig's hand and feel that it must burn. But when he looks up, worn and pale as ever, all I can drag out of what is surging within me is merely to stammer, "Have you a cigarette, Ludwig?" He gives me one. The train whistles. We go on singing. A more ominous rumble than the rattle of the wheels gradually mingles with our songs, and in a pause there comes a mighty crash that travels rolling in long reverberations over the plain. Clouds have gathered. A thunderstorm bursts. The flashes of lightning dazzle like close gunfire. Kozola stands in the window and shakes his head. "Now for another sort of thunderstorm," he mutters and leans far out. "Quick, see? There she is," he suddenly cries. We press round. At the limit of the land, in the glare of the lightning, the tall, slender towers of the city pierce the sky. Then darkness closes over them again in thunder, but with every flash, they come nearer. Our eyes shine with excitement. Expectancy has suddenly shot up amongst us, over us, within us, like a giant beanstalk. Kozola gropes for his things.
"Oh, boys," says he, stretching his arms. "Where shall we all be sitting a year hence, I wonder?"
"On our backsides," suggests Jupp apprehensively. But no one is laughing now. The city has sprung upon us, gathered us to herself. There she lies, panting under the wild light, outstretched, inviting. And we are coming to her, a trainload of soldiers, a trainload of homecoming men out of the limbo of nothingness, a trainload of tense expectancy, nearer and nearer. The train tears along. The walls leap out against us. In a moment we will collide. Flashes of lightning. The thunder roars. Then the station rises up on both sides of the carriage, seething with noise and cries. A pelting rain is falling. The platform gleams with the wet. Heedless, we jump out into it all. As I spring out of the door, the dog follows. He presses close after me, and together we run through the rain down the steps.